Mohsin Hamid's second novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was shortlisted for the 2007 Man Booker Prize. And now his latest, Exit West, has made this year's shortlist. A young professional couple flees a city besieged by militants and join a tide of migrants heading west to London and beyond, searching for their place in the world. Mohsin Hamid spoke to me via Skype from his hotel room shortly before the ceremony. So your book, Exit West, is very much about a world population on the move and the effects that that has on traditional, cultural and social boundaries. It's a very current book and it has a feeling of almost impending doom about it. And yet it's also very hopeful. That's a difficult balance to strike.
Well, I think that for me, the novel is quite personal because I've moved around my entire life. I moved to California when I was 3 from my native Pakistan. I moved back to Pakistan at 9. At that point, a California native, totally alien to Pakistan. I moved to America at 18 to study, worked in New York, London at 30. At 38, back to Pakistan. So when people speak of a growing anti-migrant sentiment and sort of xenophobia, I take those issues very personally. I feel that they're about people like me. And so I set out to write a novel some years ago that explored these trends. They have sadly come to seem even more current to us in the wake of Brexit here in the UK and Donald Trump's election in the U.S., the Syrian refugee crisis. But they've been around for quite some time. And as you say, there's a hopeful nature to the book because I do believe that human beings have always moved. I think they always will move. I think there's no reason for us to imagine that the migration apocalypse needs to be apocalyptic, that in fact, beautiful new things can come into being, and the novel is about exploring a world such as that.
And I think certainly the relationship between the young couple, Saeed and Nadia, is emblematic of the fact that two people can come from the same city and have an awful lot in common, and yet they aren't automatically going to fall in love, raise a family and the next generation, that relationships of all types can be more fluid and one should keep an open mind.
Absolutely. Say the Nadia story is a story of a first love, one that many of us will have experienced. And in a first love, it's two people who are quite different. Nadia is less attracted to tradition, formal spirituality. Say there's a gentler soul, but also a more traditional one. And they're thrown together under very dramatic circumstances as their unnamed city descends into civil war. And in those dramatic circumstances, of course, their initial romance comes to feel dramatic. In the same way that if we are on holiday someplace for 1 week and we meet somebody and we think, oh my goodness, I'm falling in love with this person, the poignancy of it being just for a week adds a heightened sense of emotion and drama to the encounter. If somebody told us instead that we had to live with that person for the rest of our lives in a very small flat, we'd want to flee. And say the Nadia experienced that too. They're thrust together as they migrate and move around the world in very close proximity, and it does result in tension between them. And they change, as we all change. And the novel is about how even when we change, and even in moments of transience, and even among love stories that perhaps do not endure or change, it's still possible to find moments of great beauty in this transience. And in fact, that human life is about transience, and that those who tell us of permanence and that things won't change are really charlatans. That in fact it's much better, as say the Nadia do, to see what beauty can be found despite change.
There's a lovely quote in the book, that we are all migrants through time and through our lives. We are migrating from one situation to another, and we have to be mutable or we don't progress. You build empathy very effectively through the book, also with little vignettes of people from around the world who are experiencing similar, if not the same, feelings as Saeed and Nadia at the same time. It's a very international book.
It is. I think that I'm interested in moving beyond the notion that some people are migrants and some are natives. Mm. I think that to be a migrant is the fundamental state of a human life. We are all migrants. And in fact, what we're seeing is really a crisis in humanity's self-conception as migrants. And that's giving rise to a lot of what we think of today as anti-migrant sentiment. And what I mean by that is if you are an old woman, perhaps born in London 80 years ago in the year 1937, and you've lived in the same house in London your entire life, you were born at a time before the Second World War. You endured the Blitz, perhaps in the countryside. You returned in the 40s and 50s as the reconstruction of the capital and the country were taking place. You witnessed the arrival of people from different places who'd come to work in the factories and the shops and the buses of the UK. You grew old. The city changed. And today, when you step outside your house, you see young people who look very different from the way they did. You hear languages that are perhaps not English spoken around you. You see your own children and grandchildren grown up. Your friends have dispersed. Many will have passed away. And instead of going out and being noticed perhaps as a beautiful young woman, you are in fact ignored as elderly people everywhere are ignored and no longer the subject of the gaze of those who pass them on the street. And your experience is that of a migrant. The city of your childhood is gone. The friends of your childhood have dispersed. The experiences of childhood are no more. And I think someone like that has equally experienced a migration, and that it's important to expand our sense of empathy to include everyone, and to find ways of uniting and dealing with this shared melancholic, but also remarkably powerful and emotional human journey.
And certainly loss is seen to be the thing that unites all the characters in the book and us more widely as humanity. The sense of loss, which is at the heart of religion, and I get the impression that religion is very important to the book as well.
It is. I think that it's important for us to, in the present moment, have a conversation around themes that would traditionally have been thought of as spiritual, and to have that conversation in terms that do not belong to any particular religion or involve any particular belief system. Partly what I think is happening today is we see different religions descending into kind of a sectarian outlook where the prime function of the religion is to determine who is inside that religion and therefore who's outside that religion and who we should be in conflict with, you know, Sunnis and Shias and Protestants and Catholics, atheists and believers. And in that process, as religion is politicized, its spiritual power is sometimes diminished. And at the same time, we have an atheist discourse that tends to attack religious belief without necessarily addressing the fundamental needs that give rise to religious belief. And so at this moment, I think as a human civilization, it's very important for us to speak of things that have traditionally been spoken of in religious terms in ways that are open to everyone, whatever your tradition or whether you have no tradition whatsoever, religiously speaking. And in the novel, that's one thing which I'm trying to do, which is to say that we all experience loss. We all experience a sense of fear at being temporary, at being mortal. And we can broaden our sense of empathy towards others to allow us to explore different ways of dealing with this. And one of the ways, of course, of dealing with this in a love story such as Exit West is love, because there are types of love that allow us to feel ourselves less central to our existence and therefore the impending end of ourselves as less of a complete annihilation of all that there is. And this is a lesson that comes to us from many religious traditions and non-religious traditions. And there are other approaches as well. So I think, yes, it is a book that tries to deal with some subject matter that's been traditionally thought of as religious, but in a way that that redefines that subject matter into terms that are open to everybody.
Well, certainly it's a very positive and beautiful story. It's also very concise. Of all the shortlisted Booker entries this year, I believe it's the shortest book. On audiobook, it was 4.5 hours long. Do you write short naturally, or do you hone down your writing to be so concise?
I tend to write short naturally, but I also aim for short. I don't write short quickly. So my first novel was 7 years in the writing. The second one was 7. The third was 6. The fourth, this one, was 4 years. So I, you know, move along fairly slowly, figuring out the form and how to make the book work. But I'm almost always aiming for a short book. I think that I like the notion of a storytelling encounter, which can take place in a single day, in a single uninterrupted sitting. Not that that's how the book must be read, or in fact, you know, should be read, but it can be open to being read in that way. It feels like a very human nature of interaction and connection to have an encounter of that length. But also, I write short books in part because living in Pakistan and meeting many people who tend not to read literary fiction, I think there's something sort of democratic and open about a short book. It feels less intimidating than a longer one. And lastly, perhaps most importantly, I believe that novelists only write half novels, that the text on the page really is just half of the experience of a novel, that the other half is written by the reader, because the reader encounters letters, words, spaces, full stops, commas. But that's not what a reader experiences. What a reader experiences are people, emotions, feelings about what things might appear to be. And those come from within the reader. That's the reader's own creation. And so in my small novels, I try to build them in such a way that maximum space is left for the reader to make their novel, much as in a conversation, if you pause and let somebody else have the time to speak, the conversation is likely to develop in a much more satisfying manner. And so my small novels are meant to be unpacked and used by readers to create large imaginative and emotional experiences that they can have, which are unique to each reader.
It's funny, actually, listening to the book as I have to, not being able to read a physical copy, it felt very much like being told a fairy story, a sort of magical but very realistic story, and being pulled into that world. And yes, it does feel rather interactive, actually. I don't know whether you've listened to the audiobook version of Exit West or to the audiobook versions of any of your books, but it's a very different experience to reading the words on the page.
I, of course, am not blind myself, but I believe that novels are encountered through the circuitry that connects to our ears. Some people will, of course, read novels with their eyes and others with their fingertips, perhaps on Braille, but once those signals enter the body, I think they enter into the processing systems that are for the spoken word. And in that, you know, in that process, the voice that's created is at the heart of how a novel works. And so most of my day, my writing day, is spent not actually typing into my computer, but pacing around my study, reading my stuff out loud again and again and again and again. It is fundamentally the oral experience of the language that I'm after. And I also think that it's the ear which we can use to hone prose. So, oddly enough, listening to an audiobook is perhaps closer to how I imagine a novel working than reading a book, you know, on a printed page. And I, in fact, narrate my own audiobooks in the U.S. editions for the most part. In the U.K., they seem to prefer an actor. They might have more exacting standards, but I very naturally narrate my work, and I think that there's a kind of element of synesthesia that goes on in fiction, where something that is seen or touched actually becomes in our minds something which is heard, and the fact that you just described that experience feels to me entirely in keeping with how I imagine novels to work.
I don't know if you know, but the Man Booker Prize arranges for audio, giant print and braille copies of all the shortlisted authors to be made available to blind and partially sighted people in the UK.
Well, that's wonderful. And I didn't realize that that was the process. I knew that, for example, my novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which was shortlisted for the Booker about a decade ago, did appear in large print, and I think perhaps also in Braille, but I didn't realize it was because of the Booker connection. I think that's wonderful, and for me, translations are very important, and I think that I would regard this in a way as a kind of, if not translation, but something similar. And the reason is that novels are a uniquely intimate experience. They are not a team sport. We don't read novels really, you know, in groups, although we might discuss them in book clubs. We tend to read novels in solitude or encounter novels in solitude. And in those moments, when we are alone, we have something very interesting happen to us as readers. We are alone, and we possess inside ourselves the thoughts of two people, because our thoughts are still present. And this writer who's narrating this book, that person's thoughts are also present. And that is a very strange and I think unique experience, you know, of a human being, the blurred nature of being alone with two people thinking inside you. I think it's a remarkably potent experience. And I think it's one which should be open to everybody. And so it is for me incredibly important that anyone who wants to be able to read my novels be able to do so. I very actively encourage, you know, translations of the books, regardless of how small the particular language might be, because I think that there is something beautiful to the intimate nature of encountering a novel, and it makes me very, very happy to know that people who might not otherwise be able to do so become able to do so through the addition of a new edition or a new translation.
Well, I'm sure that your shortlisting for this year's Man Booker Prize will have won you even more fans, and I wish you all the very best of luck at the ceremony. Mohsin Hamid, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for coming on to Read On Air.
Thank you very much. And I just like to say one thing as we end our conversation, which is, you know, specifically from the matter of someone who is blind encountering this book. You know, there's so many different mutations on what it means to be, you know, human and what a human existence is. And so often we think of things in terms of loss, you know, that we have lost our youth, or we have lost our sight, or we have lost our homeland, or we have lost our loved ones. And I think that actually these losses are a way for us to recognize, you know, the loss in other people and in a shared human experience which encompasses loss. And so in that sense, I think that it for me is, you know, particularly important that my work be open to, you know, everybody who experiences loss, because we all do. And I think in that sense, you know, blindness, my emotional attitude towards it is as something that is fundamentally human, that expands our sense of empathy. And so I'm very pleased to have had this conversation, and I hope that readers encounter something in the book that they find worthwhile.
Well, thank you. I'm sure they, and certainly I have. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.